Hello and welcome to Inside Education. We're online at insideed.com. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. On this week's programme, his was the voice of Irish educational broadcasting from the mid-1970s until well into the new millennium. But today, John Quinn shares his insights into education and life with listeners to Inside Education. John Quinn was born in Bolivar, County Meath in 1941. After attending the local primary school and secondary school with the Patrician Brothers in County Laois, he went to St. Pat's Training College to become a teacher. In 1975, he joined RTE as an educational broadcaster. He presented and produced award-winning programmes and documentaries during this time. His longest-running radio series were The Open Mind and Education Forum. I spoke to John Quinn at his home in Clarenbridge, County Galway, last August. Today I bring you the first part of that interview. In it, John talks about his own teacher education in the early 1960s. He discusses how his early years as a teacher saw him engaged in activities from purchasing canes to preparing children for Dublin Corporation examinations for post-primary school scholarships. And he compares classrooms today to classrooms 50 years ago. Given that the title of his most recent book was The Curious Mind, I began by asking John to tell me what he is curious about.
I'm curious about education and about what goes on in the name of education, what we call education, what is education, what isn't education. Really, based on my own experience originally as a teacher, and then ultimately as a broadcaster and meeting all the interesting people I did who were fairly well represented in that book. And I'm just curious about how we come to know the world, which is, I suppose, what education is about in its very broadest sense. And my main concern would be that there are so many ways of knowing that world, far beyond the formal schooling. But, you know, to so many people, education is schooling, which is really sad in a way when you think that someone has reckoned that the young person only spends 20% of his or her life in school, which, you know, raises the question, what about the other 80%? In other words, there are so many other influences, so many factors bearing on all our lives outside of the formal school system. My main big worry about the education system we have is that it is so concerned with measurement that we live in this so-called, you know, knowledge society. But knowledge is often then equated just with information. And I know it's an old kind of cliche. If you kind of the notion is, if you can stuff enough information into young people, and hopefully that they'll spew it back to you at exam time, and that as long as you can measure that in grades and honours and passes and so on, then everything is fine. But I always go back to the wonderful quote from one of the greatest minds of all time, one of the most curious minds of all time, Albert Einstein, when he said that not everything that is countable counts, and not everything that counts is countable. I've written somewhere in a book I'm just finished at the moment, that if I had my way, I would inscribe those words in stone over the entrance to every school in the country. Not everything that is countable counts. Not everything that counts is countable. In other words, there are things we cannot measure, but things that are very important to us in the way we know the world. I always go back to the old guy out in the bog in Bolivar where I came from, Johnny Kelly, who to me was one of the wisest men I ever came across. But he never went beyond primary school. But he knew his place, literally. He knew the bog, and he knew the lore of the bog, and he knew the quality of the turf that came out of the bog, and he could look at the shlan for cutting the turf and tell you who made it by looking at it. And it was purely by absorption and by practice and by working with other people that he acquired this tacit knowledge. But you see, society and our education system or whatever really only values what can be stated, what can be written down. But, you know, Johnny would never be able to write a thesis on turf or whatever, but he could tell you about it. we probably rely too much on that, and you know what can be written and what can be. And as any youngster doing the Leaving Cert will tell you, you know, to be judged on what you can write in 2 or 3 hours on a particular subject really is in many ways unfair.
And if we go back to Johnny just for a moment, and I mean, I don't want to underestimate what he knew, but is there not something important as well about knowing beyond your local area and expanding your vistas of the world and your horizons in order to have a sense of your place in a much larger universe?
Oh, of course there is, yeah. No, I mean, I don't want to be sort of portraying this kind of idyllic, nostalgic, you know, the wise man down in the bog kind of thing. But I'm just saying that is one. Here's an example of one way of knowing the world. And if yes, there is, and yes, we must go beyond the bog, and there must needs be schools and universities and so on to get that wider knowledge of the world. But it's how we go about it. I mean, I think one of the criticisms you'll probably find if you speak, and I'm sure you have spoken to people at third level, is that young people coming in, to them, for all the distinctions they have at Leaving Cert and Junior Cert level, they very rarely, very few of them know how to learn. You know, they've just, as I say, been spoon-fed stuff you know, they throw it back at exam time. But one of the ways I think our education system, or our school system, fails is that it doesn't promote, if you like, curiosity in that sense of young people finding out things for themselves and finding out in a kind of collaborative venture. It's such, again, such a competitive world we live in that you know, you have to be. You have to get ahead of the other guy. You have to get more points, and you have to get more grades, and you know that's the way to get on, rather than working together with them. That's why you see such wonderful results in things like the, you know, the Young Scientist competition. I shouldn't say not competition. That's a Freudian slip. Exhibition. It's not a competition in that sense. But it's a wonderful example of where people of that combination, if you like, of curiosity, where youngsters just want to know why this is so, why that happens, and then come together, usually as a team or as a group, to find out. But that, in a way, happens almost outside the formal system. And, you know, it depends really on how much value the school will give to it, will allow, and thankfully they do, most schools give them time and encouragement to pursue these lines of inquiry.
John, you left St. Patrick's College 50 years ago this year. What kind of a place was St. Pat's back then?
It was such an innocent world. It was, you know, it was 1961. It was before, really, the swinging 60s. We just staggered out of the darker 50s. It was, you know, from television. Television only opened that year, the same year in 61. And, you know, the great technological revolution or something hadn't happened, so it was a very different world. And I suppose I've written that somewhere else. We would have taught the way we had been taught, you know, which is, you know, perpetuating this almost the Mr. Gradgrind thing, you know, give them the facts, teach them lots of things. And I mean, I cringe still today when I think of some of the stuff I carried out in the name of education. But again, I was teaching in my first job was out in St. Finglas West in Dublin, a new suburb then bursting at the seams, because it was families who had been moved out from the inner city, endless rows of houses, housing estates, and with practically no facilities. Schools, yes, a big church, and hardly any even shops, no such thing as shopping centres then, no sports facilities and so on, but wonderful people. But, and again, and those, this was even before the days of free education. So one of the assignments I actually got in my within a few years of starting was to prepare the scholarship class. You see, because these were the Dublin Corporation scholarships, which would enable parents who couldn't probably otherwise afford them to send their young lads on to secondary school, which was a big thing. And of course, what did I do? I mean, I prepared them. I studied the past exam papers and tried to figure out what was coming up. And I drilled them and I drilled them and I drilled them. And I remember I got, this is a big confession for you now, I got 10 scholarships, which was almost unheard of for that school, for St. Fergal's. And Eddie Devlin, Lord of Mercy, and the principal, was so thrilled, he gave me a tenner, pound per scholarship, just for myself, you know, talk about. And
payment for results.
Payment by results, yeah, which was 19th century education. And when I say that now, there's a cutting there that I sometimes have asked to give talks about this kind of stuff. And it's a page out of the Irish Times. It's 5 or 6 years old now, but it was about this, it's an interview with this 600-point girl. Yeah, the girl who had got the magical 600 points. Beautiful girl, photographed in UCD, whatever. And I highlighted certain sections in it where she said, you know, I studied all the past exam papers. I knew exactly what was coming up. I knew exactly what was required. If the teacher said, this isn't actually on the course, but you'll enjoy it, I switched off, you know. And I don't blame the girl. I praise her. She played the system and won. But I blame the system. But here, you know, when I say that now I suddenly realise I was doing the same thing myself 50 years ago. It was a very different world, and we were, you know, you come out at 18 years old, and really, we knew nothing. We were stumbling in the dark, but we did our best. And as I say, we taught as we had been taught, and I suppose. Again, it was slowly through things outside of the school, you know, getting involved with other young teachers. And there was a thing called the Teachers Study Group, which was set up, which would be, you know, people, young teachers who were in the Dublin area who would organise debates and lectures and so on. And it's that kind of way that suddenly you sort of, I suppose, your mind opens out and you become aware of what you're doing and what you might be doing and so on. But we did our best. We did our best.
In association with Dublin City Council, 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
What were the 10-year-olds like at that time in 1961?
Well, they wouldn't. That's the other thing, I suppose. Well, they would be lively and lovable in their own way. They would be quite disciplined was a huge thing then. Any of the teachers would have kept them on a tight rein, and they wouldn't have what today's 10-year-olds have in terms of, you know, I suppose being streetwise and knowledge of the world. And there was no corporal punishment was still a big thing then. I remember, they talk about confessions of an aging teacher. I remember when you went, there was a wonderful shop down in Dame Street in Dublin, Healy's, which was a stationery shop and school supplies shop. And you went in there at the beginning, about another few weeks now, end of August, September, you'd be buying your copybooks and boxes of chalk and pencils and nibs and ink powder to make ink, you know, this would make show you how long ago it was. But you'd also probably buy a half dozen canes, you know, masters, teachers, canes with a nice little crook at the top of it. And a half dozen, like, in case there might be breakage during the year.
So it wasn't just a Sally Rod?
No, it was the Sally Rod in Bolivar, where I went to school, where Master Conway sent Mickey Fagan out to cut a good Sally Rod. And I tell you, the Sally Rod was even worse on your fingers. And, you know, God, I hope I didn't damage any physically or psychologically any young lads. But again, this is what we had experienced ourselves. And it was more the threat of it, I suppose. But you'd hear, you know, I know people have stories of being flogged. And even I found it, even at second, when I went on to boarding school, you'd be, get, you know, slogs, as we used to call them, for failure at lessons, you know, for getting a poor result in a test, or for not being able to decline your Latin nouns and whatever. So there was that threat there, but you hopefully, as I say, I didn't need the six of them, or even the one of them. But they were, in answer to the question, they were grandkids, and they were. But as I said, they wouldn't be as outgoing, probably as free and as liberated as today's kids are. Certainly, they wouldn't. They would be much more innocent because, as I say, it was before all the technological revolution now that the children know so much. But again, one of the things that I go back to when you're talking about education, a friend of mine who's in that book, The Curious Mind, a few times, Mike Cooley, who's a wonderful engineer, but a wonderful mind, and a very curious mind. But he makes the point that children today have so much knowledge. They know so much, but it's secondary knowledge. They've looked it up on the internet, or they've seen videos, or they've seen DVDs, or they've learned it through games or whatever. But they have so little primary knowledge. I see. The point he makes is that many of today's children have had the experience of a worm crawling across their hands and in and out through their fingers, and studied it and felt it and seen it. And, you know, because it probably health and safety wouldn't allow you to do it now. But I've actually done that with one of the things I do nowadays as a writer. This wonderful scheme, Writers in Schools. But I've gone out to the garden there, dug up a dozen worms one morning, bought them in a plastic bag full of earth, brought them out to school, spread them out in the newspaper, and asked the children to pick up a worm and look at it, watch it, study it closely. How is it made? How does it move? What colour is it? What is it? What do you think it's feeding? And then write about it. And of course, some kids just won't do it, and you can't force them. You know, they wouldn't touch such a dirty, wriggly thing. But most of them do. But and again, I hasten to add, all the worms are gathered up at the end. No worm is harmed in the experiment. And they're all returned to my garden, where they probably wreak horrible revenge on my potatoes.
And John, if you were to look back on the 50 years, say, the teaching that you did back then and that was going on generally back in the early 60s to what's going on today, what are the biggest changes in the kind of work of teaching between 1961 and 2011?
Oh, God. Well, I suppose I've probably covered some of them. That the teaching, in a sense, is a different job. In many ways, it's a much more challenging job because of, you know, the way society has changed, the way the world has changed. That children of 2011 are very different children to the children of 1961. You have to bear that in mind. Also, you are, we were, I suppose, a relic. And I say we, the class of 1961, we were a relic of the village schoolmaster, you know, who was the icon, who was the up on the pedestal, and still they gazed, and still whatever was the wonder grew that one small head could carry all he knew. And that, in a way, was a bad thing, because you were seen as the font of all knowledge, and you were supposed to also the pillar of society. And I suppose the democratization of education has changed all that, thankfully. And now the parents of today's parents are much more educated and much more involved and know what's going on in schools, and they want to be part of it. So the teacher really is in a different kind of he's not, or shouldn't be, I think, just sealed away in his little box in the classroom and doing his own thing at one level, yes, but he's also really a partner with, or should be a partner with the parents and with the community. And he's also, it goes back to that notion they used to have years ago of education was a three-legged stool, you know. It was school, home, and school, parents, and community. And if one of the legs is not the same length, you know, the stool gets a bit buckety and falls over. But also, of course, there's the whole technology thing. When I go into schools nowadays and see these marvellous whiteboards and what the facilities that the teacher can have, assuming that he or she is, you know, confident in their use and well able to use them. And also, by the same token, that the kids, as I was saying earlier, know so much more. And it's not a matter of, you know, the wise old teacher sitting up there at the top of the class and revealing the wonders of the world. I mean, a lot of today's kids could probably teach the teachers, but it's that's why, in a way, it you know, I suppose liberates or frees up today's teachers to be more of the facilitator, and as I was saying earlier, of helping children to learn how to learn, and learning with the children. So it's a very, very different scene. Again, I keep getting nostalgic now when you brought up this class of 61, but remember I had a discussion with a group of them some years ago, and one of them said that, you know, one of the big problems every day was getting the old fire going in the classroom. And remember when I was young myself, you usually had to hold a newspaper in front of the fire to let it draw, as they say, to get a current of air going to light it up. And he used the blackboard to sort of put it in front of the fire to get it going. And of course, one morning the inevitable happened. The blackboard went on fire and he burned a big hole in the middle of the blackboard. And he went to the parish priest, and the parish priest said, well, there'll be no money for that kind of thing. You know, you'll just have to do with what you had. And he said, for the next while, I don't know, a year or years, he said, I was doing my long division sums on the blackboard, down one side of the hall and up and down the other side of the hall, in the middle of the blackboard. I mean, that's as bad as it was. So, I mean, today's schools are brighter. The village I went to school in, Bolivar, they've just last year opened a magnificent new school. I mean, it is state-of-the-art stuff. And they give me the great honour of the name, the library in the school after me, because I was the local boy, made good. But that kind of facilities they have there now, within the classroom, outside the classroom, they have music rooms, they have meditation rooms, they have teachers, they have resource rooms. It's probably ahead of the posse and that, but that's the way it should be, you know. But for years, a lot of teachers, you know, had to plod along with the blackboard with the hole burned in the middle of it.
And what advice would you give to someone setting out on a career in teaching today?
The first thing you should ask them: do you really want to be a teacher? You know, is it just a job, or you know, what is motivating you? And I think that happened, again, going back to my own group, that we came from a time where, you know, there was an O-point system, and there were, if you couldn't afford university, there were kind of, it was the bank, the civil service, or teaching. Mm-hmm. And as a result, and they were quite talented, in that sense, quite bright and intelligent young men and women went into teaching, but a lot of them went into it that probably should never have gone into it, and then suddenly found themselves buried maybe in some small school down the country or in a city school in a job that they really hated. So that's the first thing, I suppose, would be to question your own motivation. I mean, teaching is relatively well paid now. Is that just the reason you're going in? But to go in, if you pardon the expression, with an open mind or a curious mind, and to go in knowing that, you know, you're never it's a strange kind of a profession. You're never going to be fully satisfied. You're going to have good days and you're going to have bad days. You're going to have some days are diamond, some days are stone. You're going to get someday a kid whom you really had doubts about is going to give you an answer that knocks you flat, you know. On other days, they'll all seem to be flat. But it's that you're setting out on a journey. Kind of sounds a bit maybe poetic now. With the youngsters, that you are with them, that you want to find out about the world. And there's so many ways of knowing it. And yes, there are the obvious ways, and you have to please the department and inspectors, and you have to stick to syllabuses and so on. But nowadays, again, as I said, because of the technology and because of the way the world is, there are so many ways of knowing the world. And that's why I'd, you know, be adventurous, you know, take chances, take risks, bring people into the classroom, bring grandparents in or whatever, you know, the Johnny Kelly who come in and talk about whatever it is, the bog or turf or whatever, and be aware of possibility. thing I was telling you about earlier, the Writers in Schools project that I'm involved in, where you're invited as a writer for children after schools. I have this pattern where I tell the youngsters, look, said, they want to be a writer. Said, all you need to be is four things. You need to be a sponge, magpie, a daydreamer, and a cat. And of course, at this stage, the teacher is kind of looking anxiously around and wondering who let this Lulu into the classroom when the kids are puzzled. But I don't have to explain to you. You know, the sponge is be open, be observant, keep your eyes and ears open, watch what's going on, listen, look, learn in that way. The magpie is the collector. The magpie collects shiny things. There's always an expert in the class. There's always some bright spark in the class who knows this, that magpies are attracted to shiny things. And I want you to collect not shiny things, but ideas, stories, names, characters, words, very especially, and be interested in words. The daydreamer, of course, gets you in trouble with the teacher. We've all done it as parents and teachers, given out to our poor kids for, oh, you're a dreamer, you'll never be any use to you. Stop daydreaming, this is a harsh world of reality, whatever. But, I said, not all the time, you can't be daydreaming all the time, but it is a good thing to do because you're using that wonderful gift you have of imagination. And I just give them a little exercise to do, close their eyes for 10 seconds and go wherever they want to go, the whole wide world. And you can see them smiling and giggling and whatever, and then you ask them. And of course, they've gone anywhere from Chocolate Land to Disneyland to Crow Park or the New Camp or Lansdowne Road or whatever, or to the jungle or into space. But what I really love, sometimes you get wonderful answers, like the little girl who said to me, where did you go? I said, I went to my granny's house because that's where she found comfort and warmth and love. And this other little fellow, here's someone in a school here in Galway, says, I was drawing bales on Tommy Brennan's tractor. You know, you could have gone anywhere in the world, but to him, that was heaven, to be up in the tractor with Tommy Brennan bringing home the bales. And that's the wonder of imagination. And that's what I tell them to be. The last one, of course, then is sponge, magpie, daydreamer, cat. You know, what killed the cat? And it's amazing how many 21st century children will tell you that curiosity killed the cat. Where did you hear that? My granny said it to me, or my ma said it to me, or sometimes, unfortunately, teacher said it to me. I said, why? Because I was being too nosy. I was asking too many questions. And I said to them, look, if anyone ever says that to you again, you tell them that I said that's the greatest load of rubbish I ever heard. Listen to what I'm saying. Curiosity is a bad thing? No, curiosity is a good thing. How did you learn when you were two or three? What little three-letter word did you learn and did you drove your mammy and daddy mad with when you were two or three? And of course, they know, it's why. And I said, well, why should you stop asking questions now when you're 10 or 20 or 40 or 80 or 90? You don't. And I said, to be a writer, to be a learner, to be a human being, you need to be wonderful because writers are wonderful. They're wonderful. They're full of wonder. So be wonderful. And the same applies, you know, to teaching, and to their advice to teachers is to, if you can try and encourage the children that you're lucky enough to be with to be all those things, sponges and magpies and daydreamers and cats. That's a start.
And that's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to my guest this week, John Quinn. Next week, I'll bring you the second part of my interview with John. For now, from me, Sean Delaney, thank you for listening.